Okay, we will start.
Feeling back through contact
the six sense bases, name and form, and consciousness. But now, instead of going directly from craving to feeling, I find it easier to begin the next three factors with the six sense bases. This is on page 331 of the book, starting with paragraph 48. Okay, where the monks ask Sariputta to explain another way in which a noble disciple is one with right view. And then Sariputta says, when a noble disciple understands the six sense bases, the origin of the six sense bases, the cessation of the six sense bases, and the way leading to the cessation of the six sense bases, in that way he is one of right view, etc., who has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so at this point I just want to take the six sense bases. So what are the six sense bases? I'm in paragraph 50 now. There are these six sense bases: the eye base, the ear base, the nose base, the tongue base, the body base, and the mind base. Okay, what is meant by a sense base? In the case of the first five senses, the sense base, here the Pali word is ayatana. Okay, the word sal means six, and ayatana is what is translated as base. In this case, the sense base. So what is meant by a sense base? For example, the eye base. The eye base is not actually the physical eye as we know it. Not the complete organ that we call the eye, but it's said to be a subtle type of material substance inside the eye that is sensitive to light, color, form, shape. It's that aspect of the eye which is able to register the impact of visible phenomena. Perhaps using the terminology of contemporary physiology, it might correspond to the rods and cones. Okay, so the rest of the eye organ, the gross physical eye, all of that serves the basis, or all of that serves the function of supporting the eye base. We have different components in the eye which are able to, I don't know, I haven't studied ophthalmology, but there's a lens which either expands and contracts, is that what it does? According to the amount of light coming in. To focus on near and far. The cornea is what?
The cornea is out of focus.
Okay, anyway, I'll settle for an F.
D minus.
Okay, maybe that will console my mama that I didn't get an F, but I got a D minus. Okay, but the important point from the Buddhist standpoint is that everything within the eye organ is built around the eye base, and it's the eye base alone which actually registers the incoming light, colors, shapes, forms, and then transmits them. Perhaps the eye base would also include, again, I'm going into a risky territory, the optical nerve, and maybe the centers in the brain that are concerned with sight. But in the ancient Buddhist physiology, it's identified with a subtle type of material substance located at deep within the physical eye. Okay, similarly, the ear base is not this particular piece of flesh that protrudes out this way, but it is a type of material substance inside the ear, which is sensitive to sounds, to vibrations of the air, and it turns those vibrations of the air into sounds. And so everything else in the physical ear, is intended, is built around that subtle material substance, and is intended to assist the ear base in hearing sounds. Again, the nose base is not this particular protuberance coming out this way, but it's a type of material substance located up inside the nostrils. Would be the olfactory, not the nerve, but there's olfactory sensors which are able to pick up odors. And then the tongue is not the whole physical tongue, but it is the tongue base, is not the whole physical tongue, but it's the type of subtle, sensitive part of the tongue, the part which is able to sense different flavors, different tastes. And then the body base is not simply the whole physical body, but it's a type of subtle material substance spread out over the whole body, which is sensitive to tactile sensations, textures. Okay, those are the five physical sense bases. Then there is the mana, it's called the manayata. This is what is translated as mind base. That's responsible for mental activity, but actually the manayatana, the mind base, is not the material substance. It's not the brain, not physical nerves, but it is considered the special organ, we might say, the mental organ of purely mental activity. The Abhidhamma actually identifies the mind base with the totality of consciousness. So this seems a little strange to me, I have to say, but I'm not sure that this captures the original intention of the ancient texts. But we could say simply that the mind base is considered to be a kind of mental organ, which is a base for actually for mano-vijnana, for mind consciousness. And the mind base has the function of, it cognizes, the mind base has a different function than the other, than the physical sense bases. The physical sense bases are each tied exclusively to their own particular object. The eye base responds only to visible forms, colors, shapes. Perhaps we should say it responds only to colored patches, light and shade. The ear base is sensitive only to sounds. With the ear base, one doesn't pick up any visible forms, only sounds. Similarly, the nose base picks up only odors, the tongue base only tastes, and the body base only tactile sensations. But the mind base functions in a different way. The mind base can cognize, it can objectify the objects of the all the five physical senses. And so it's through, for example, through the mind base that I might compare two shades of blue. And I will recognize these are two shades of the same color. It's the eye base picks up the visible form, but the eye base doesn't distinguish them. The eye base simply is something like a camera. When you take a picture with a camera, the camera simply takes the light, the colors, the shapes, and directs that light to, I don't know how cameras work now. They're just changing so much. But the old-fashioned cameras would direct that light to a strip of film, and then that film will turn out a picture, become the basis for making photographs. And so in this case, the eye will take the two shades of blue, but it's not able to distinguish them, not able to recognize them as shades of the same color. It simply brings in the two shades of blue, but it is the manayatana which will identify this is blue, that is blue. Also, it would be the manayatana which will distinguish shapes. The mind base distinguishes the shape. The eye base will bring in the colored patch. But it will be the mind base that will distinguish that colored patch is a circle. That colored patch is a square. That colored patch is a rectangle. It's probably the mind base too, which will distinguish dimensionality, especially the third dimension. That can tell whether a particular surface, a particular image is a flat surface or a three-dimensional object. Okay, the mind base also can distinguish sounds. The ear base doesn't hear words. All it does is take in the sound. But for the ear base, all the sounds are meaningless. But it is the mind base operating on the sounds brought in by the ear base that can interpret the sounds as meaningful words. Similarly, the nose base just takes in odors, will be the mind base that can distinguish, ah, this is the scent of a rose, this is the scent of a lilac, this is the scent of somebody cooking a curry dish, and so on. The taste, the tongue doesn't distinguish tastes, it just brings in the tastes, but it is the mind base that distinguishes, this is the taste of this food, this is an apple, this is a banana, this is lettuce. Similarly with the tactile sensations. Okay, so the mind base distinguishes the objects of the other five sense bases, and it also coordinates the objects of the other sense bases. So, when I see a round red object, then touch it with my hand, take a bite out of it, and feel it break off into my mouth, and then get a particular taste out of it. The mind base coordinates all of these sense impressions and applies to them the concept, this is an apple. Or if I press a button on a machine, then some sound comes out from the machine, and then I distinguish, hear the sound, and distinguish, this is a piece of music, say Mozart or Bach, coming out from this machine, and it's my mind base that is able to make the determination through this machine, I am listening to this piece of music. This machine is playing that piece of music. Okay, so this is part of the functioning of the mind base. The third function of the mind base is to apprehend, to know its own particular class of objects, a kind of object inaccessible to any of the other senses. These are purely mental objects. These would be, for example, non-sensual, non-sensuous concepts. How do you know that 2 + 2 = 4? Let's do a little thought experiment. I take a bag, I look in the bag, it's empty. I open the bag, turn it inside out, completely empty. I take 2 apples, put them in. Take another 2 apples, put them in. I open the bag, and lo and behold, there are 5 apples inside. Like, this is strange. I pour the apples out, eat 1 apple or throw it away, so I only have 4 apples on the table. This time I take 3, put them in the bag, take 1, put it in the bag, open the bag, and again 5 apples. Do I conclude that 2 + 2 = 5 and 3 + 1 = 5? No. I still know that 3 + 1 = 4, 2 + 2 = 4. Why is that? Because this is not a datum of the senses. Even if every time I look, I see any 2 objects put together with any 2 objects, 5 objects appear. But I'll never think 2 + 2 = 5. Because mentally, I know that 2 + 2 = 4. This is a purely conceptual operation. Okay, so this is just one instance of the way the mind base works. But all of our whole structure of ideas, relations of ideas, judgments, ways of systematizing things, ways of interpreting the world, probably the sciences, theoretical sciences, even technology, all of it is built up upon the working of the mind base. So the mind base is a very, very complex organ. Okay, so these are the six sense bases. Any questions? Maybe I'll ask whether there's any questions at this point.
Did I understand you to say that the mind base correct in understanding that the mind base is not rooted in materiality?
Okay, this is a good question. The question is whether the mind base is rooted in materiality. What I said is that the mind base itself is not material. It's not a material organ. But according to the Abhidhamma, within our human experience, the mind base always functions on the basis of material phenomena. In other words, it always functions on the basis of a physical body, and particularly those material phenomena within the body that function as, there's another word translated as basis, function, that parts of the physical body that function as the basis for mental processes.
Question. I think you said there are three sort of jobs of the mind base,
right,
to distinguish and coordinate the other sense bases.
Yeah, that's and, two. That's two.
Yeah, I missed the first one, I guess.
Yeah, the first one is to distinguish and to sort of apply conceptual labels to the objects of the other senses. The second function is to coordinate the sense objects of the five physical sense bases. Then the third is to cognize its own particular class of objects, abstract ideas, abstract concepts, judgments, relationships of ideas, and so on.
And then I'm just curious, why the distinction? Is it purely Buddhist knowledge of biology? Why the distinction between the ear and all of its components and ear base, for example?
I actually don't know. I would just say that probably at that time the Indian physiology was already aware that it's not this part of the ear that hears and not this part of the nose that smells. But they would have been aware that the part that's actually sensitive to the corresponding sense objects is something located deep within each of these organs.
Thank you.
Okay, one question written. So the mind base takes in as object, takes in an object stored in the brain, the memories, and tries to make sense. First, Buddhist texts never speak about the brain as being involved in the process of cognition. It could simply be that the function of the brain is not understood in this period. And then, it's not only the case that the mind base is using memories. Of course, memories, recalling memories, this is also a function of the mind base. But also the mind base applies concepts to objects in order to make sense of them, not only past memories. Okay.
Are the five physical bases the aggregate of perception?
The what?
The aggregate of perception. Does aggregate okay. of perception in... does the mind base already come into play in the aggregate of perception or... just the five physical?
Oh, of course, the mind base is also involved in perception. But the physical sense bases don't belong to the aggregate of perception. They belong to the aggregate of material form. But perception always functions on the basis of one of the six sense bases. Even it could function on the basis of two sense bases, the mind base and another sense base. But perception is a mental function, whereas the five physical senses are material, physical. Okay, I want to move on now. Okay, now we've gone through the six sense bases. Now we're going forward now, which means we're going back actually. So now we go from the six sense bases to contact. And this takes us to paragraph 46. What is contact? What is the origin of contact? And so on. Okay, so what is contact? There are these six classes of contact. Eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. The Pali word here is translated contact is pasa. Pasa means literally touching, but it is not physical touching, but a kind of mental touching. Okay, a number of suttas define contact as the coming together of a particular internal sense base, the sense faculty, with the object and with consciousness. So the meeting of these three things, sense faculty, object, and consciousness, this is pasa. This is contact. But the way I understand contact more specifically, I say that it is the meeting of the particular type of consciousness with the object through the sense faculty. The sense faculty functions as a door, an opening through which consciousness can go out and meet the object. Or it can be a door through which the object comes in and meets consciousness. When I speak about going out and coming in, I'm speaking metaphorically, don't take it too literally. But we could say that consciousness arises based on the particular sense base, and on the basis of that sense base, that sense faculty, it's able to know the object, to experience the object. And thus we have six types of contact which are connected to the six sense bases through which they arise. When contact occurs through the eye base is called eye contact. When it occurs through the ear base, it's called ear contact, and so on. But when it's purely internal cognition, like in reflection, in memory, in abstract thinking, in forming judgments, opinions, in elaborating on conceptual knowledge, then it is mind contact. The mind is contacting its own objects, ideas, concepts, images, memories, through mind consciousness is contacting its objects, concepts, ideas, images, judgments, memories, through the organ of cognition, the mind base. Okay, so these are the six types of contact, and what is their origin, what do they depend on? With the arising of the six sense bases, there is the arising of contact. Okay, so now we move from contact forward, or actually backwards, to feeling. And so we go up to paragraph 42. What is feeling? What is the origin of feeling, and so on? There are these six classes of feeling. Feeling born of eye contact, feeling born of ear contact, feeling born of nose contact, feeling born of tongue contact, feeling born of body contact, feeling born of mind contact. Okay, so when contact takes place, whenever contact takes place, immediately there occurs a particular type of feeling. That is, contact is the condition. So we have, what is the arising of feeling? What is its origin? With the arising of contact, there is the arising of feeling. This means whenever contact takes place, immediately, without even a split second interval, a feeling arises. And that feeling is conditioned by the nature of the contact. If contact takes place through the eye, then there's a feeling that arises based upon that eye contact. So if I see something pleasant, I go walking by the Seven Jewel Lake with the trees blossoming over the lake, maybe some ducks swimming on the lake, very pleasant scene. That's a pleasant contact, and it gives rise to a pleasant feeling. If I go walking down a dirty street with people fighting and yelling, then I get unpleasant impressions through the eye, then there's a disagreeable contact. Gives rise to an unpleasant feeling. And so with the other senses. Okay, so the feelings arise through the senses. They could be pleasant feelings, painful feelings, neutral feelings. And they're all based upon contact. And then this feeling feeds into craving. When there is a pleasant feeling, that is usually the bait for craving. That's what craving thrives upon, is a pleasant feeling. But when one undergoes a painful feeling, then there comes a craving to sort of blot out or eliminate that painful feeling by indulging in some kind of pleasure. And when there's a neutral feeling, if it's a peaceful, quiet, neutral feeling, then there can be a subtle attachment. attachment to that pleasant feeling and a craving for it to continue. Or if it's a dull, boring type of neutral feeling, then there comes a craving to drown out that dull, boring, neutral feeling with something exciting and enjoyable, delightful. This is what all of the advertising agents know very well. Okay, so any questions now on contact, feeling? This is that Richard? Please.
It seems that you said that the feeling comes almost directly intrinsic to the senses, that there's no cognition involved with what we feel about what's coming in through the six senses.
Okay. Yeah, this is an interesting point. It's actually a very complex process. In a way, in giving the examples, I oversimplify it to a great extent. Because they're, to a certain degree, what comes in through the senses will make its immediate impact, and that immediate impact will give rise to one type of feeling. But then there will supervene upon that a cognition of what's been experienced through the senses, and then that will give rise to another type of feeling, or can give rise to a different type of feeling. Okay, so for example, as I, to use the example that I gave, as I walk by the pleasant lakeside scene, these sense impressions, the flowering trees, the calm water, the grass around it, has a pleasant impact on the sense, giving rise immediately to a pleasant feeling. But then I might cognize, all of this is impermanent, not lasting, don't become attached to it, and then that will be followed by a neutral feeling, a kind of withdrawal from that sense experience.
So once again, there's an intrinsic feeling associated with certain kinds of sights, sounds, smells?
Yeah. Of course, maybe somebody whose mind is very highly developed will be able to overcome that intrinsic or immediate feeling. But let's say an ordinary person who's, say, trying to practice the Buddha Dhamma, developing the mind in meditation, maybe he's looking through a magazine, he turns a page and there's a picture, it's a young man, let's say, and there's a flashy model dressed, wearing a sexy dress, so immediately it makes a strong impression on the mind, and it will start to arouse, well, first the pleasant feeling comes spontaneously, but then, since he's studied Buddhism, he'll recognize that this is just, well, he could do it from different angles. This is just an image on a piece of paper, colored patches on a piece of paper, or even taking the real object, this alluring image of the woman, this is just an enticement to sensual indulgence, let me withdraw my mind from this, and so on. So then he can overcome that feeling. Similarly, with when we meet a hostile, aggressive person, a person that we've had an intense relationship with, when we see that person, there might come instantaneously a disagreeable feeling. But then, very quickly, we might arouse maybe the mind of loving kindness towards that person. Or even think, this person is my benefactor, since if it wasn't for this aggressive person, I would have no opportunity to practice patience and loving kindness. So he's actually helping me develop my paramis, my spiritual virtues. And then one will develop a pleasant feeling when one sees that person.
I have a question about the pleasant and
painful feeling. Those terms actually are quite subjective. It may be various, you know, among people. Some people may find this man, you know, pleasant.
Oh, that is, of course, that is very true. Yeah.
Then what factors determine, you know, why we feel pleasant and why we feel painful to a certain, you know, contact?
I think to some extent I would say it's built into the senses. To some degree it's determined by one's past experience, one's personal inclinations, dispositions. This becomes, as I said, it's a rather complex matter, and to understand this in detail, it's useful to study the Abhidhamma, which distinguishes, we call, the bare sensory impression and then the mental activity that builds on the sensory impression. So the sensory impression, according to the Abhidhamma, has a built-in disposition to, it's almost an objective disposition to respond to what's pleasant and painful in a fixed way. But the mental activity that follows that immediate sensory impression brings along all of one's past experience, memories, unconscious impressions, one's personal inclinations, dispositions, one's present intentions, which can then transform the way one experiences the sense objects.
You talk about past experience. Do you also include those experiences in our past life? Because when babies come in contact with different things, they actually have their own feelings already.
Yeah, I think definitely past experiences from past lives will affect the way one experiences objects.
Thank you.
Okay, one question from the back.
When consciousness meets an object through one of the sense doors, is the very first thing that happens a sensation, which then the sensation is cognized from the mental base and judgment is made, and then the feeling is created around that cognition and judgment. But when it first, the first contact is an almost a neutral or pure sensation, and then the mind from that creates the feeling based on.
Even at the first, with the first impact of the object, there's already a feeling arises as soon as the contact takes place. So that is, we call this maybe the ground level feeling. But then based upon that ground level feeling, the mind starts to process the incoming flow, the incoming impressions. Then as the mind processes the incoming impressions, then it evaluates the impressions. Well, first, even before the evaluation takes place, it merges the impressions into a clear cognition. That will bring its own feeling. Then based upon that clear cognition, it will evaluate the object. That will bring still another feeling. And so in this way, there's a very complex process taking place, each one accompanied by different feelings.
I've often heard it taught that aversion is another form of clinging. And with the craving and clinging, can you give some interpretation about how that aversion fits into that craving and clinging? And
yeah, actually it's not quite true that aversion is itself a form of clinging. Clinging is a strengthening or an intensification of craving. And so we see the types of clinging enumerated here. There's sensual clinging, and then clinging to views, because views satisfy certain cravings. But aversion arises through, we can say, the obstruction of one's craving. When one has a craving for something, and then somebody or something prevents one from fulfilling that craving, that gives rise to aversion. So aversion is kind of offshoot of craving or clinging. But it's not a form of clinging itself.
Okay.
So, I mean, aversion isn't listed here as a
dependent origination. Yeah. Because dependent origination, it's enumerating the factors that are responsible for binding one to the wheel of birth and death. And aversion doesn't have that function. It's an unwholesome root, it's an unwholesome quality, but it doesn't have that sticky, binding quality. Okay, then there's one written question. Do patients with Alzheimer's disease lose feeling since memory is no longer accessible? From the standpoint of Buddhist psychology, one has to say that feeling is present whenever there is experience. In fact, even in deep sleep, when one is completely unconscious, there's some feeling occurring, even though one doesn't clearly recognize that feeling. So as long as there is conscious experience, even in the deep unconsciousness of sleep, there is some accompanying feeling. I think we're going to have to move on. I'm sorry, but this is not a question and answer session. I just want to explore all the different ramifications of this. I just want to get the questions to make sure that the basic points are clear. Okay, so now we go back to the six sense bases. Why are there the six sense bases? What is the condition for the six sense bases? With the arising of name and form, there is the arising of the six sense bases. This is nama-rupa. Okay, so now we have to find out what is name and form. Now we jump ahead to paragraph 53, the bottom of page 331. When a noble disciple understands name and form, its origin, its cessation, and so on, then he is one of right view. Then paragraph 54, and what is name and form? What is its origin? Okay, so now name and form is a compound. It's a dual compound, two terms. What is called name or nama. So name or nama and rupa, which is form. Okay, now the tricky part of this is nama, which I've translated very literally as name, but it it doesn't actually mean a name, like a person's name, like Richard or Miranda. But according to the sutta, okay, let us just look at the definition. What is name or nama? Feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. These are called name or nama. And then what is form? The four great elements and the form derived from the four great elements, these are called form. Okay, so what is meant by nama is not actually a name, but I would call it a group of mental factors, the group of mental factors play the primary role in the cognition of any object. In all experience, in every act of cognition, there is a set of mental factors which are constants, ever-present factors essential to the cognition, to the act of cognition. Those constant factors are what make up nama. And I think they are called name because it is these factors that are responsible for the naming, the designation, or conceptualization of experience. In using the expression nama rupa, the Buddha took over an old term that was already present in Indian philosophy from a very early period, going back probably to the Vedas, certainly to the Upanishads. And I think the way the Upanishads use the expression nama rupa, it refers to the entire phenomenal world. The whole phenomenal world is considered nama rupa. And so when one has, for example, when one sees a person, then the way the Vedic texts use the expression, when one designates the person, that is John. This is nama, and then the physical form of the person is the rupa. And so according to the Vedas or the Upanishads, this whole world is just physical form and the designation of physical form through mental activity. And all of this is seen as just a superimposition upon the underlying reality, which is called Brahman. Okay, the Buddha took this expression, nama rupa, and used it in a different way. He used it to designate the two components of an individual person. The mental component, excluding consciousness, is nama. Everything that consciousness uses in order to cognize an object, to conceptualize it, to designate it. All of these factors that assist consciousness are nama. And then the physical body, this is rupa. And the physical body consists of the four primary elements: earth, which means solidity, water, which means fluidity or liquid, heat, the fire element, which means heat, vital heat, and the air element, which means vibration, oscillation, expansion and contraction. And then the form derived from the four elements, which is the form of the physical sense faculties, the form of the sense objects, and other types of material phenomena. Okay, then to make up nama, we have these factors that are present in all cognition. Whenever one knows an object, first I would put contact, even though it's listed later, but contact is the initial engagement with the object. It's the meeting, consciousness meets the object. That is contact. With contact, there arises feeling. One experiences the object in a particular way as pleasant, painful, neutral. There is perception. One distinguishes the object. This is an apple. This is an orange. That's a flower. this is a man, this is a woman, this is my friend, this is a stranger, all of this perception. Then there is volition, that is, one forms towards the object some intention. The mind is moved in a particular way to respond to the object. And then there is attention. One directs the mind towards some particular aspect of the object. And then, out of the vague background of impinging sensory phenomena, something will attract one's attention. And so one then diverts the mind to that particular object that's attracting one's attention. When one turns the mind to it, one makes a fresh contact, a new contact, followed by a new feeling, new perception, new volition, until something else attracts one's attention. Then there's another contact, followed by its feeling, perception, volition. And so this is the whirlwind, the whirlpool of mental activity, which makes up nama. Okay, and when we have the name and form, this begins at the moment of conception, when conception takes place in the womb, and then from this developing name and form in the womb, let's put it this way, at the very moment of conception, at the very moment of conception, there is present two of the sense bases. At the very moment of conception, there is present the body base, that one-celled fertilized egg itself has the body base. It's able to experience its environment through some kind of sensations around the membrane of that cell. So that is the body base. And there's some kind of mind base that is the mental cognition, even though it's not a clear and distinct cognition, but there's an arising of mental activity based on that one cell fertilized, on that single fertilized cell. And when the mind base arises, let me say, at the moment of conception, the body base, the mind base arise. The mind base is accompanied by some feeling, very primitive, very simple, but there's a feeling there. There is a perception, very simple perception. There's some volition, some attention. Those are present even at the first moment of, the very moment of conception. You might ask, how can there be feeling, how perception, how volition, if there's no brain? But take an organism like an amoeba or a paramecium, one-celled organism. But we could see it moving around in the water. I remember when I was a little boy, I used to have a microscope and used to look at the little one-celled organisms that we used to get out of the drop of water from the flower pot. And you see them moving about. If you take a little pin and you touch the organism, it will feel it'll show that it actually experiences some irritation and annoyance. Well, maybe I'm projecting. But who's that guy pricking me with that pin? It's not thinking in that way. But if you take a little pin and touch it, bring it near, will sense danger and move away in the opposite direction. How could it do that if it didn't have some perception some kind of feeling, some kind of volition. All of that is present. Okay, then as the one-celled organism starts to develop, to mature, it brings out first in the form of like little buds. Eyes start to form, ears start to form, nose starts to form, the tongue starts to form. These are the other sense bases coming into being, evolving, developing, till they reach maturity and can function actively. So this is how from name and form there arises the six sense bases. Okay, now I'll go on to the next step in the sequence. Okay, what is the origin of name and form? I'm still in section 54. With the arising of consciousness, there is the arising of name and form. Okay, so then we go to the next section. Paragraph 58, what is consciousness? What is the origin of consciousness? Okay, there are these six classes of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. Okay, so this is the standard way of analyzing the factor of consciousness, dividing it into six types of consciousness. But I have to say, not intended as a criticism to Buddha, but this formulaic way of treating how consciousness is a condition for name and form in this particular sutta and elsewhere, in other suttas on dependent origination, doesn't make it very clear exactly how consciousness is the condition for name and form. But I found this is treated better in a passage that comes in the Mahanidana Sutta. This is Sutta number 15 in the Digha Nikaya. And this is on the handout that I gave you. Okay, so here the Buddha is speaking to Venerable Ananda, and he says, how consciousness is a condition for name and form should be understood in this way. If consciousness does not descend into the mother's womb, name and form would not take shape in the womb. So in other words, name and form, these are the bodily and mental sides of the living organism. And in order for name and form to take shape in the womb, in other words, for a living being equipped with a body and a mind to arise in the mother's womb, consciousness, vijnana, has to, here the word, the text uses a metaphorical word, it has to descend into the mother's womb. Or phrase another way, we have to say that consciousness has to arise in the mother's womb. Or we should say that the consciousness has to link up with, to connect with, the fertilized ovum. If the ovum is present in the womb, but no consciousness is present, which is karmically connected with this situation of the parents, the environmental situation, then conception will not take place. But it is when some stream of consciousness is present, the consciousness which comes from a being who has passed away earlier, and that consciousness has all of the appropriate karmic connections with the parents, the family, the environment, the life situation, then that consciousness will connect to the fertilized ovum, and then conception takes place, and the life process begins. And when consciousness links up with the fertilized ovum, it turns that fertilized ovum into what we call form, the form body of a living being. And when consciousness links up with the fertilized ovum, it brings along the factors of nama. It brings along contact. It brings along, let us say, the consciousness is able to make contact. When consciousness makes contact, it gives rise to a feeling, a perception, a volition, and then there is the act of attention, even occurring at a very simple, very primitive level. Okay, so this is the first way consciousness is a condition for name and form, that consciousness initiates the process of conception. Consciousness initiates the new life. Consciousness turns the fertilized ovum into the form body of a living being and starts the series of factors that make up nama, that make up name. And so name and form take shape in the womb. Okay, then, in the second place, if after descending into the womb, consciousness departs. In other words, if some accident happens to the mother and the stream of consciousness is cut off, if she has an abortion, consciousness is cut off, if, I don't know, through some karmic, deep karmic factor, consciousness gets cut off, then the developing embryo dies. And so name and form, the name and form that makes up the living individual, the person, does not become, would not be generated into this present state of being. In other words, name and form that's developing in the womb does not emerge from the womb in the form of a living person, a full-fledged human individual. Okay, and then supposing that the pregnancy comes through to completion, and then the living being emerges, the baby grows up, becoming a young boy or girl. Always the individual, through the whole course of their life, is this interplay of consciousness with name and form. But if in the course of life, consciousness is cut off, either through some forceful intervention, cuts off consciousness, or else through the exhaustion of the karma, some illness, then name and form, this compound of bodily and mental factors, would not grow up, develop, and reach maturity. Okay, so in this way, consciousness is the condition for name and form. Okay, maybe at this point I'll ask whether there are any questions. Okay, Sandy.
the name and form is actually the four actors, right?
Okay, this is a good point. Yeah, she's saying that name and form are the four aggregates. Yeah, very good point. We could say that the form, what's called form here, is the form aggregate. Feeling, perception, volition, these make up the feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, and the aggregate of volitional formations. Then the other factor is contact is actually the condition for feeling, perception, volitional formations. And attention, usually the Abhidharma texts put attention and contact into the fourth aggregate because there's no place else to put them. So they put it into the fourth aggregate. Yeah, so we can say that these are the four aggregates which go along with the aggregate of consciousness. That's a very good point.
Some trees, when they interpret the name and form, they also have the consciousness in it. Is that...
Okay, this is also a good point. We find in the commentaries, perhaps in some earlier texts, consciousness is put in with name, nama. But in the early suttas, consciousness is not put together with nama, but consciousness is made the condition for name and form. But I don't think this means that we should reject the later text as being incorrect, because it seems to me that nama rupa can be taken as a somewhat flexible category, especially nama. So from certain point of view, it might be useful to include consciousness within nama. But when explaining dependent origination, then consciousness is excluded from nama. Yeah, we have to stop early today because today is the 1st or the 15th of the lunar month, and so there will be the special offering ceremony. Let me just see. Yeah, anyway, these long questions that deal with very theoretical matters, I can't answer right now. If there's any question that just needs, if something is unclear that one wants clarification, about which one wants clarification, then I'll take the question.
It's not related. I know that we do not have class next week.
Oh yeah, I'm going to make announcements about that.
Sorry.
Okay, then we have to stop for this morning. Yeah, I'm going to make these announcements. Yeah, some announcements I'll make first about the upcoming classes. See, today is the 9th. The 16th, we won't have a class. The 23rd, I originally had a class scheduled, but there's going to be a meditation retreat going on then, so I have to cancel that class. And so the next class will be May 30th. Then June 6th, I have to cancel the class because I have to attend some other function. But we will then have the class June 13th, June 20th. I will send out an announcement about this too, so everybody is informed what dates we have the class. And if anybody wants to attend, Venerable Dhammadipa, the abbot of Tuangyan Monastery, he will be giving a 4-day, 5-day meditation course on the Brahmaviharas starting May 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 24th.
26th.
To 26th. So 22nd to 26th.
21st to 26th.
21st and 26th, 5-day course. Okay, then some other quick announcements. Tomorrow will be the celebration of Vaisakh, that's the Buddha's birthday, enlightenment day, passing away day. It will be celebrated at Kwangyan Monastery with a garden party. And the most important event is the bathing of the little newborn Buddha. So everybody gets a chance to bathe the Buddha. Then we have, followed by a garden party, that will be tomorrow, 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. outside the Great Buddha Hall. And then tomorrow, the Wu Ru Library will be opening to the public for the first time in years, opening tomorrow at 1 p.m., I think, and then in the future, it will be open every Saturday from 1 to 5 p.m. in the afternoon, and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's the Wu Ru Library near the entrance to Kwangyan Monastery. Okay, we'll do very quick, very short sharing of the merits. I'll do it in a quick style. And for the next class, please bring these handouts that I gave out today. And then we'll finish the dependent origination next time. Okay, so let us do the sharing of the merits. Deva naga mithika punyanta anumodipa chiram rakantu sahasanam akasa ta chubuma ta deva naga mithika punyanta anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam akasa ta chubuma ta deva naga mithika punyanta anumodipa chiram rakantu mam pram eta ta cha mehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Okay, we'll have the discussion group at 12 o'clock. Anybody questions, points to discuss? Then I can also take some of these written questions at that time.